You're listening to Novum, a podcast about science fiction and speculation. I'm Ari Brin. I bet you've heard this story before. A character begins to notice glitches in the Matrix. Perhaps she realizes that her memories don't match up with accepted history. Or maybe her dreams seem more real than do her waking hours. Then the truth is revealed. She is able for the first time to bear witness to actual reality. What she was living in before? A simulation, a dream, a parallel world, a dome, you name it. This sort of plotline in all of its permutations never ceases to amaze and entertain us. And characters throughout literature and film history have been trying to escape the known world for the unknown. Think Neo in The Matrix, rejecting the comforts of his simulation by choosing the red pill, one that shows him his physically true life in suspended animation. Today, I want to talk about the search for the real. In just a moment, I'll welcome my guest Yogesh Rao to the program, who has spent a lot of his academic career thinking about this very topic. In our first segment, Yogesh will take us through the rich historical context of the search for real reality. Apparently, these are questions that have dogged sentient creatures since the birth of civilization. They appear in early philosophy, religion, and throughout art. Next, we'll chat about the psychological reasons behind questioning reality, and why humans are so fascinated with the question, what if this world isn't real? And if that's so, do we even want to find out what is? Finally, we'll wrap things up with a little science fiction chat. Shows and movies that talk about this very idea. And we'll focus on The Man in the High Castle and the Netflix series, The OA. And there's plenty more to come, so stick around.
All right, I'm going to ask you a series of questions. Just relax and answer them as simply as you can.
PhD candidate in social psychology at New Mexico State University. He has a master's degree in cinematic arts and critical studies from the University of Southern California, a master's degree in psychology from NYU, and a bachelor's degree in psychology from Stanford University. So thank you for coming onto the program to discuss this with me. This is actually a topic that you brought to my attention, and I want to ask how you first started thinking about all these very, very deep philosophical quandaries.
So when I first kind of started taking an interest in film and cinema, it must have been around the late 90s, so right around the time, 1999 or so, when Hollywood was really in love with this idea of sort of simulacrum, right? So there were a number of really big movies from really well-known directors, either directors well-known at the time or who soon would become very well-known, that were based around this idea of characters trapped within their own subjectivity. And one of the first was Alejandro Amenábar's Open Your Eyes, which was one of my favorite movies when I was in college, and it was later remade as Vanilla Sky by Cameron Crowe in Hollywood. Aside from the direct remakes, its influence was certainly seen in a lot of other movies that came out around the same time, most notably The Matrix, you know, and even on through Inception, right? But even at that time, the late 90s, early 2000s, you had sort of science fiction-y movies like Open Your Eyes, The Matrix, Alex Proyas's Dark City, and also movies in sort of other genres like fantasy and thriller like Memento, Fight Club, The Others, Mulholland Drive, right? All by major directors and all that sort of revolved around this idea of characters who begin the narrative trapped within their own subjectivity and subject to illusions because of this, and which dramatized their journey toward attaining a sort of fuller and more objective notion of reality.
Right. And I think that especially The Matrix has influenced our culture so much. And the idea of the red pill, just the idea that you could actually escape your reality right now.
Yeah. And they chose to center their narratives around it, which is an interesting choice.
Right.
Yeah. And around that time, you know, I was taking my freshman year at Stanford, I was taking I was in what's called the Structured Liberal Education Program, which was sort of humanity-centered and focused program that, you know, tried over the course of the school year was kind of tracing the history of thought, mostly Western thought with some Eastern philosophies as well, kind of from the beginning through the present day. But it started by looking at, you know, Hindu philosophy, the Bhagavad Gita, things that I had sort of, in a general sense, been raised with, but, you know, really kind of took a deeper dive into because of this course. Right. And my father at that time gave me a translation of the Bhagavad Gita that had been published in the 40s by Christopher Isherwood, the famous British author, but it had an introduction, a foreword by another famous British author, Aldous Huxley.
Who was especially interested in escaping reality throughout his life.
Yes, yes, and a key figure in science fiction as well as, you know, literature in general.
Absolutely, the author of Brave New World, most notably.
In the foreword, he discussed what, you know, became what was known as the perennial philosophy. I think he later expanded into a book of that title. But he specifically discussed sort of Hinduism and the Gita in general as sort of a clear expression of this philosophy. But he argued that it was found in virtually all of the world's faiths and religions to some extent. Right. And this, what he termed the perennial philosophy, had sort of four key elements to it. All right. And I'll directly quote kind of from the Wikipedia article that summarizes it. One, the phenomenal world is the manifestation of a transcendental ground. Right. So in Hinduism, they talk about Atman, the sort of individual self, and Brahman, which is sort of a larger concept. Sometimes it's equated with God, but it's I think more accurately can be thought of as sort of an ultimate unity, a sort of single essence that everything else manifests from.
Okay.
Right. The idea then that sort of our perception of ourself as a self, as an individual, is sort of an illusion which results from our estrangement from Brahman, our perception that we are somehow separate from everything else. And sort of within Hinduism, philosophically, the goal is to kind of overcome this split, this dissociation from everything else by recognizing our ultimate sort of unity with Brahman, this transcendental ground. Right? So that's kind of the first aspect of it. The phenomenal world, our material world around us, is a manifestation of this transcendental ground, but we're not aware of it.
Okay.
Right? Secondly, human beings are capable of attaining knowledge of that ground. So with the proper sort of effort and direction, we can become aware of this transcendental ground. Third, in addition to their phenomenal egos, human beings possess a transcendental self which is of the same or like nature with that transcendental ground. And fourth, this identification is life's chief end or purpose. So this is why I drew attention to the fact that these narratives I was discussing choose to make their central focus the sort of dissolving of the boundary between illusion and reality, the sort of escaping from the simulacrum into a higher, deeper, more authentic knowledge of reality.
So this is a pretty ancient idea that comes far before the 90s. Okay,
right.
And so he's making a claim that this perennial philosophy comes from many of the world's religions and philosophies.
Yeah, also, I mean, yeah, in Western thought, right, there in Plato's Republic, he says the allegory of the cave, sort of imagining that, well, we live in a world of shadows, basically. So, you know, imagining basically humans chained in a cave looking at, and all that we see are shadows of things that are cast, you know, by a fire. And he basically posits the idea that beyond this, there's a world of sort of ideal forms, the things that are actually casting the shadows that we're not aware of. And sort of as a metaphor for sort of gaining of knowledge is sort of the discarding of our belief that these shadows represent ultimate reality, and a recognition that it's actually the forms behind them that are the ultimate reality.
Okay. One of the people in the cave unchains himself or herself and escapes out to the world of the real. And that sort of reflects these later movie plots that base their entire plot around escape to out of the cave, so to say.
Yeah, it's a very compelling narrative that turns up over and over again.
And you mentioned actually another example that I would like you to speak a little more about, the Lotus Eaters. And I think that'll lead us to our next point in conversation. Could you explain that for people who aren't so familiar with that story?
Right. So, I mean, the basic story comes from the Odyssey of Homer in Greek mythology. You know, one of the many sort of perils that Odysseus faces on his voyage, trying to return home to Ithaca after the Trojan War, is an island. So yeah, the people on the island were often called the Lotophagi, or Lotus Eaters. Basically, the primary food on the island was a narcotic. You might think of it as, you know, like a opium type poppy thing. Basically, the people who ate, because this was their main food, the people who ate it were basically in a constant state of sleep and apathy. Right. And in the Odyssey, this is sort of a dangerous thing for Odysseus because it represents the temptation to sort of be lulled into by this sense of peace and apathy, and to not complete his journey, to not return home.
Right.
Yeah. Now, in the 19th century, a famous poem by Alfred Lord Tennyson called The Lotus Eaters reinterpreted this, right? It was sort of a dramatic monologue from the point of view of a group of mariners who happened upon this island, who eat this lotus, who enter in an altered state, tie it back to Huxley and his love of psychedelics.
But they have a different reaction to the lotus eating. They have a different sort of moral philosophy on it. Is that correct?
Right, yeah. In the end, they decide to kind of join together and abandon the world. And they say, you know, surely slumber is more sweet than toil, the shore than labor in the deep mid-ocean wind and wave and oar. Right. They choose the peace number over the hard labor of fighting against the ocean.
I'm sure many of us can relate to that. I find it interesting that sort of escape is almost the direct opposite to the escape, let's say, of Neo in The Matrix, who chooses to divest himself of this semi-pleasurable reality into the harsh, cold, you know, reality of the world where he must fight and possibly die. So this escape into sort of pleasure, that's quite interesting. And I think Huxley is a good window into this, because in many of his works center around islands of free thought and liberty and drug use, which I think the Lotus could stand in for a drug. And like Soma in Brave New World, Soma is the drug that is consumed by pretty much the entire society as an escape, an easy escape from the world around them.
Right. It's a term he took from Hindu mythology. Again,
too. Soma is right. Really?
Yeah.
Oh, wow. That's quite influential throughout science fiction. That's interesting.
We know in an obscure and profound way that in the depth of our being, in what Eckhart calls the ground of our being, we are identical with the divine ground.
That was Aldous Huxley in his 1955 lecture, Who Are We? Coming up, we'll take a look into the psychology of skepticism and the potential dangers of escapism. With films coming out now like The Discovery, in which mass suicides result after the afterlife is confirmed, will a loss of faith in this reality lead to disaster? Okay, let's start out by talking about The Truman Show. It's a 1998 film starring Jim Carrey. I think that's one of the most shocking and affecting portrayals of escaping your reality into the real. And the visuals of that film all play into it. I'm sure that you've at least heard of this movie if you haven't seen it. And I haven't seen it in actually a very long time. But in it, a man, Truman, is living his normal life. He's never strayed too far from home. But in fact, his life is being watched by almost everyone on Earth. There's hidden cameras everywhere. Everyone in his life are actors. And he actually lives inside this enormous dome that he has purposefully never been able to escape from. So everything in his life is fake. It's all acting. And there's a common phenomenon, actually, after people watch this movie called the Truman Show delusion or the Truman Show condition, where people are so affected by this film, and I'm sure this has also happened with The Matrix, that they start believing that their life is actually a reality show and that everyone in their life is an actor. And this is quite common, I think, after watching the film. I don't know if you felt the same after watching it.
I mean, I think that, yeah, that's kind of a fantasy, not as a full-blown delusion, but certainly as like an imaginative fantasy, something most people have probably had at some point as children, right? As children, we tend to be very self-centered. We see the world through our own eyes, and at a certain point, you know, especially among sort of more imaginative children, I think we start to think about, well, what if, what we're seeing through our own eyes is that organization is what reality is. It's literally all there for our benefit. You know, it's all being staged for us. Yeah.
Yes, I definitely think as children that's rampant. But I think adults are prone to this kind of thinking as well. I wonder if all these movies, if this sort of preoccupation with searching for the real, divesting yourself of reality, it could lead to a form of paranoia.
That's a good question. And I think, I mean, you know, for me as a psychologist, right, my question is sort of where it could lead is tied to the question of sort of, you know, where it comes from in the first place, where this sort of like quest for something real comes from. And it, right, if people are looking for something real, it suggests that they detect something inauthentic in the world around them.
Right.
Which is an interesting question about sort of where that comes from. And I think, you know, on the one hand, as humans going through life, it becomes difficult to sort of deny the fact that humans are very illusion-prone creatures.
Yeah. Right?
As we, you know, we can talk about sort of, you know, at a broader level, how much of society is built around illusions. Like, I mean, our monetary system, for example, you could, I think, persuasively argue is an illusion. You know, many things about sort of the power structures that we hold and sort of the ways in which we structure our lives are built around, you know, what sociologists would call social constructs, which are, so that term is often kind of misapplied to say that things that are social constructs are fake, right? They're not. They're very real. They have a very real role in structuring the way in which, you know, and societies and cultures function. And we interact with them as though they are real to the point where they are essentially are real.
Yeah.
But at the same time, right, there's something constructed about them, which implies that they are kind of illusions that could be swept away. But on a personal level, in terms of kind of how we see the world, right, at a perceptual level, we're all prone to illusions, right? We've all sort of seen these sort of optical illusions, for instance, the Miller line illusion, the two lines that are exactly the same length, but one of them will always look longer than the other, right? You've probably seen something like that before. Right. So on a very basic perceptual level, you know, we can't trust our senses. And then at a sort of, sort of social cognitive level, we understand that, you know, everyone's sort of prone to prejudices and how we judge other people. We don't really have perfect knowledge of others. So we sort of fill in the blanks with our own sort of suppositions, which are based on stereotypes and prejudices often. In terms of decision making, right, the psychologists have cataloged all sorts of cognitive biases. People are prone to, base rate neglect, loss of people who are interested can look at the work of people like Daniel Kahneman and so on. But the basic point is that, you know, our minds can't really be trusted, right? Perceptually, cognitively, at a motivational level, all of these things are sort of pushing us to see the world in a distorted way, and other people around us also see the world in a distorted way. So at a certain point, we have to, I think, become aware that human cognition is flawed, human perceptions are sort of, you know, what the term is sometimes used is boundedly rational, but basically irrational, deviant from sort of perfect rationality. At the same time, we also have to become aware that our minds are capable of creating simulations that we can't tell from reality. And we become aware of this pretty much the moment we fall asleep. Because once we fall asleep, we start to dream. And the moment we dream, we are essentially inside a world that seems perfectly real to us, to the point that the only way we know it isn't real is that eventually we wake up from it.
Right.
So, yeah. So all of these things are sort of telling us as human beings that there's something off about the world, about the way it works, that there's something, we're not designed to be perfect, and there's a possibility that whatever we're experiencing at the moment just isn't real at all.
Yeah.
And so this sort of, I think, can trigger this kind of speculation of like, well, let's take it to its logical extreme. Let's say that, you know, let's just take this idea that the world might be an illusion and say, well, okay, the world is an illusion. Well, once we have that thought, we have to say, well, then what is real? And, you know, then we start to imagine, well, maybe this is sort of, maybe this isn't what we should be caring about. Maybe we should be striving for something deeper and truer. And I think these narratives all kind of begin in that.
Absolutely. I think that's an important point to ask yourself, what is real? Because maybe reality, it wouldn't be anything that we could recognize as part of our human experience. This is an incredibly deep philosophical topic, and I know that this has been discussed relentlessly in philosophy throughout the ages. But there haven't really been any conclusions reached about this, have there?
Right. I mean, in a way, you know, you could argue that as, you know, humans track our own subjectivity, it might be impossible for us to actually conclude that, right? But it's still a dramatic idea, right? As you know, in Plato's allegory of the cave, you know, the human who comes to that realization, the first thing they feel is pain. Like, literally, they've been living in a cave their whole life. When they're exposed to light, they literally, you know, would recoil from that sensation of this sort of overwhelming light, right? It's too much for them. It's painful. And then, you know, the next step of it is this desire to enlighten the rest of humanity, to free everyone else from their chains. But when they do so, they're met with conflict, right? Because people who haven't reached that state of enlightenment, they're resistant to it, and they don't want to be, you know, set free. So it's a very kind of a dramatically compelling notion, a narrative, even if they're sort of, you know, we can't speak to the sort of how true is it.
It
feels
absolutely.
On a personal level, right?
Yeah, I guess we've all collectively decided that this is our reality. We just have to live with it.
Yeah.
You were saying that if this were a simulation and people recognize that, the way we behave in our world would fundamentally change. And I think I hinted at that earlier with the stories about the afterlife. The fact that they suddenly perceive that as this world isn't real, that world is real, so what I do in this world doesn't matter, and then you get the suicides and the murders. Because, you know, it doesn't matter when you die, you're going someplace different. Your life doesn't end. So I'm wondering what you think of the perhaps lack of accountability that could come from the realization we're living in a simulation.
Yeah, that's a very powerful idea, right? And it sort of speaks to, I think, the broader question you're asking, which is kind of why these narratives are so common and what makes them compelling.
Yes.
Right. So as sort of a student of narrative, right, the question of what makes certain narratives compelling was tackled by, you know, the father of structural anthropology, Claude Lévi-Strauss, the famous French academic, right? And his, you know, he devoted his whole life to this question, but sort of the boiled down simple version of it is that, you know, when humans live in society, there are certain sort of opposing, so basic contradictions that arise as a result of how people live. And there's something irreconcilable about this contradiction that we have to turn to stories in order to reconcile. And the most right. compelling stories, right, are the ones that do the best job of reconciling these contradictions. Right. So on the one hand, I think, you know, and this is sort of, you know, something that sort of, you know, in discussing it, you know, an idea that kind of came up, you know, when I discussed with people about why these narratives speak to them. On the one hand, there's this very compelling need we have to escape from accountability, to escape from responsibility, right? It's the burden that society places on all of us. And so to accept that the world is an illusion, whether it's, you know, a reality show designed for us, or a dream, or a fantasy based around us, or sort of a lotus-eating machine that some external intelligence imposed on us, either way, it involves accepting that sort of the mundanity of our lives and all of the burdens that come with it really don't matter. And so that burden, that sort of, you know, knapsack we're all carrying around as a result of our lives, we can just put it down and, you know, not worry about it anymore. And then when we act in the world, we can feel secure in this knowledge that our actions don't really come with consequences, that sort of the consequences that we associate with reality, right? The climax of the Matrix is a perfect visualization of this, where the literal material world around him dissolves. He discovers he can manipulate it in accordance with his own ends. He can therefore go around, you know, shooting up things, putting bullets in things, shooting people. It doesn't really matter. And even, you know, death, even, you know, a bullet in his own brain, that entire sensation of death, even that turns out to be an illusion he can take mastery over. Right. So these are very compelling fantasies, right? This idea of abandoning all responsibility, having total mastery over the material world, being able to bring about anything we fantasize. So, you know, on the one hand, there's a very sort of compelling need that's served by this sort of fantasy. But for every need that's served, there's a complementary need on the other side, right? And I think this need can be thought of as sort of the need for authenticity, the need for things to actually matter, right? This is dramatized, I think, in the recent HBO series Westworld, right? Set in a park where people are allowed to go and enact their fantasies. And it's set up as sort of a simulation of the Old West, but the characters who they interact with, there might be, you know, villains, Old West style villains with guns. They draw their guns, they fire, but they don't, those bullets don't actually harm the guests, right? And as certain guests keep saying throughout the series, there's something missing there. You know, when you can't actually get hurt, it doesn't really matter. It doesn't really have meaning the way we sort of, as humans, seem to really thirst for meaning.
Yeah, and the story in Westworld is very disassociated from reality, and not only in that it's a representation of a bygone world, the Wild West. There's also robots that assume the likeness of humans.
Yeah, and it sells you on this idea of immersing yourself in a reality, but ultimately you can't immerse yourself fully because you can't really feel pain and loss the way you can in reality.
And I think that's also visualized in Groundhog Day is what that's reminding me of, strangely enough, where Bill Murray's character starts to realize that his life, his days are practically meaningless, and he ends up trying to kill himself in increasingly absurd ways.
I have been stabbed, shot, poisoned, frozen, hung, electrocuted, and burned.
I've actually seen that in so many movies and shows. In the Twilight Zone, when a man is granted immortality, at first he's loving it, but he realizes he can't die, so he's just trying to kill himself all the time. And once you lose that actual sense of danger, then yeah, I could see life becoming quite pointless.
Yeah, there's even an episode of Bewitched, a show we don't normally think of as sort of, you know, deep in a philosophical sense, where, Darren allows Samantha, you know, gives in and allows Samantha to kind of use her magical powers to make his life better. And, you know, he eventually realizes that, like, he can get what he wants, but he can't derive satisfaction from it, because satisfaction comes from the actual sort of struggle. Right. So these narratives, yeah, overall, they serve that need. They allow us to sort of play with this fantasy of being free from accountability, but they also assert that sort of true meaning arises from a world in which accountability really does exist. So we can put aside this sort of world we're trapped in, but we still have to embed ourselves in some kind of real world.
Right, and the fact that Neo isn't just escaping to something, you know, heaven, he's escaping to a world that he truly believes his actions matter more in than in the simulation. I think that's really vital, and that's why stories, those by Clark, ones in which the new reality we achieve is so much better and we're actually destined for this, they kind of surprise me, because I do see that storyline a lot more often, where characters escape to the real, so we call it, and then they sort of have this dawning realization that they actually desire to get back to, you know, the world that they know, one of hardships. I grew up watching The Fairly Odd Parents, which is a kid on Nickelodeon who has two fairy godparents, and of course in every single episode he wishes something like, I wish my parents didn't exist, I wish I had all these powers. And in every episode he's granted that wish, and he ends up regretting it and asking them, please make it how it was again.
Yeah, but there is sort of, yeah, I think an interesting kind of dichotomy in terms of how that sort of enlightenment is achieved, right? The films that I began by talking about were very much sort of, like Hollywood films in general, protagonist-centered. They were about sort of specific individuals who undergo this journey. It seems like the sort of the science fiction novels you seem drawn to, especially the Arthur C. Clarke ones, are about an entire civilization or culture that sort of takes this journey together.
Right.
Would that be a good way of putting it?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, some of them. I mean, there are quite a lot of examples where that it's the individual, but I think... that, yeah, also in alternate history texts, which is sort of another, you know, way in which a civilization kind of searches for the real. I think in alternate history texts, often what happens is that the characters in these stories, in these alternate histories, where, let's say, the medieval era never ended and now we're in the 1960s and there's no real technology. There's a theme of characters sort of having this knowledge, this sort of disturbing knowledge that the world that they're living isn't the right one. They have this disturbing feeling that there's a right track that humanity's supposed to be on, and they're not on it.
Yeah, and those stories sort of represent a very interesting, I guess, playing with this trope we've been discussing, right? In that the vast majority of narratives we can think of start with our world, or one very similar to it, and argue that that is the simulation, the simulacra, the artificial one that needs to be escaped from. But these sort of alternative history type narratives kind of invert that, in that they posit the world of their characters, the strange and unfamiliar one to us, is the illusory one, and the world we currently live in is the higher one that one can achieve transcendence by becoming aware of.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely.
And that's kind of what I wanted to sort of talk a bit more about, the Man in the High Castle, in that sense, right? That's sort of the most famous of those alternative...
Probably the best known alternative history texts.
Right. Yeah, so what I was kind of hinting at earlier, the scene that always stuck with me, and you know, maybe this is my own idiosyncratic reading, you know, other people may take other things away from the narrative. But the one scene, you know, that stuck with me as crystal clear, even, you know, 15 years or so after I've read it, no pun intended, and you'll see why that might be a pun in a second. Right, so there's a character in this, Tagomi, right, the Japanese. I know you've read the book much more recently than me, so you can probably correct my sort of, if I get any details wrong. Right. Okay, so in this alternate history, you know, the Axis has won World War II. The U.S. has been divided up among kind of the Japanese and the Germans. And, you know, the sort of deportations of Jews have continued the way they did during the Holocaust, right?
Yes, absolutely.
Right. So there's multiple storylines within the book. There's this Japanese industrialist, Tagomi. There's also this man, I think his name is Frank.
Yes.
Who is Jewish, but is passing as non-Jewish, who's hiding his ethnicity. Right. And he creates this crystal, and, you know, sort of it shows up within Tagomi's storyline. Tagomi is drawn to it. He doesn't really know why, but he purchases it and he uses it as a guide to meditation.
Yeah. Right? One of the most interesting scenes in literature. He designs a new American artifact of jewelry of the kind that hasn't been produced in a very long time, and it's sort of an abstract work of jewelry rather than sort of the classic replicas that we've seen.
Right. And then he uses this to meditate, and at a certain point it turns out, I think, to be the book's sort of emotional climax. He meditates himself into a vision of a world that is completely different from the world he's living in, a world where the Allies have, in fact, won World War II. And, you know, this is a very sort of brief glimpse he has of this world. But when he comes back into his own world, he has been altered.
Yes.
Just, right. And to me, this is sort of the thing that stuck with me is, you know, because we keep discussing this, and we sort of skirt around the idea of this perennial philosophy being a religious philosophy, a faith-based one. But it is very central to it is this notion that shows up in so many of the world's religions, which is enlightenment.
Yeah.
Right? You know, the idea that at a certain point you see something, you grasp some truth about the world, and once that happens, nothing is ever the same again.
Yes.
And, you know, once, you know, in the story of the Buddha, for instance, he meditates 40 days underneath a tree, and then afterwards he reaches that state of enlightenment. And, you know, what he can put into words what he has to say. You know, in Buddhism, there's Four Noble Truths, there's an Eightfold Path. There are so many words that are written that can kind of literally explain the sort of enlightenment. But reading them doesn't make you enlightened. You have to live it. You have to have that physical, phenomenological experience of seeing the world, seeing something in the world that changes the way you look at it. And you can't say that literally. You just have to go through it.
Yeah, I think that's a prime example of this phenomenon. And that's such an interesting point about Man in the High Castle, is that Tagomi is, in a very subtle way, and one I missed my first reading through, he is very temporarily transported into a world in which there's buildings he doesn't recognize. He goes into a cafe and the Americans aren't standing up and giving him their seats. So it's a very subtle view into this world. And yeah, it does come from meditating with this object. And he's also in the right mental state for this. He's just committed an act of murder, justified murder, but that's shaken up his religious self and challenged his fundamental moral beliefs about the world.
And then, so remember then what he does after that, right? He comes out of this state, he's very shaken, and then he signs an order, right? Do you remember what that order is?
Oh, gosh. You'll have to remind me.
Right. So he basically orders.
Yes. Okay. Go on. I just remembered.
Right. He orders the freeing of Frank. Right. The guy,
yes,
who, unbeknownst to him, was the creator of this crystal, whose Jewishness had been discovered, and who was about to be deported to these camps.
Yeah.
And So he basically signs an order freeing him, and he can't really articulate why he does it. He can't justify why he does it. Certainly, it's, you know, not in his best interest to do so, but he just acts. He just, without thinking, he just acts.
Yes.
And this is, this is a moment that jumped out at me because it connects with, I think, one of the most, the strongest recurring themes in, I think, sort of modern Western literature, right? Which is the idea of the defiant act, the meaningful defiant act.
Mm.
So, you know, in going back and, you know, maybe the first sort of modern American short story, Bartleby the Scrivener, right, that the title character is a this figure who basically sits in an office, and anytime he's asked to do something, he responds with the same five words: "I would prefer not to." And so early on in American literature, you have this sort of clarified, pure vision of sort of the defiant act, in this case sort of taken to the point of absurdity, because he's not really rebelling against anything, you know, specifically. It's the mere notion of being asked to do something that he's, you know, just sort of being purely defiant about. And what makes this so potent, I think, is that sort of, again, as children, we all feel this urge to defy authority, right? We're all, you know, and when we're not sympathetic to the person who's doing it, it does seem like a very childish and petulant act. But it also, you know, fundamentally can be the most moral and courageous act in the world in certain contexts. Right? Absolutely. The idea of civil disobedience, you know, of Rosa Parks not, you know, giving up her seat on the bus, of, you know, Mahatma Gandhi's bulk march, of just sort of marching forward and you know, not stopping even while being beaten, right? And depending on context, this most childish and petulant act can be sort of an act of moral courage. But as humans, we keep struggling with this idea of when is it right to act in that way? When is it right to defy authority? When we do it, are we just being spoiled, stubborn children, or are we actually taking a really meaningful and important stand? And this is a really, you know, difficult thing, I think, that all humans kind of struggle with in their life. They're all sort of seeking this, the moral clarity that will allow them to know that their actions, that their decision to not join with a system that is urging them to go in a certain direction, to go against that current, is the right thing to do, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, and you know, throughout, you know, Western literature, especially, you know, U.S. and U.K. literature, you see moments of these acts, you know, the teacher in Terence Rattigan's Browning version, the teacher refusing to kind of give up his speaking spot, in Alan Sillitoe's The Loneliness of the Long Distance Runner, the runner sort of stopping right just short of the finish line, refusing to finish the race. You know, even back in Huckleberry Finn, Huckleberry, you know, tearing up the note he's going to send, informing Jim's location, and deciding he'd rather, you know, go to hell than inform on the runaway slave that he's now friends with. One of my favorite books, one that was a huge influence on me in college, Catch 22, there's a chapter that begins with the three-word sentence: "Yossarian marched backward." Right? It's so, you know, potently captures this idea of basically when there's a force around you telling you to go in a certain direction, sometimes the most powerful thing you can do is just not do it, to do the opposite of it.
Right. And in a way that is defying at least some form of reality.
Yeah, and it is, you know, and it speaks to this, yeah, again, this idea of sort of, in this, you know, maybe another reason these stories speak to us is that the illusion that we're transcending maybe isn't the literal material world we're trapped in, it's the sort of cultural world, the cultural forces that tell us that we must be a certain way, even when being that way is not in our best interest or in society's best interest.
Yeah.
And there's a recent work of, I think can be classified as science fiction, some might argue with that, and maybe I can't discuss it without going into spoiler territory, but I'm referring to The OA, the recent series on Netflix, created by Britt Marling and Zal Batmanglij, a filmmaking team who've done a lot of really interesting work in the past few years. Without summarizing the whole thing, which is, you know, but it's basically, you know, this woman appears to who tells a story of having been kept in captivity. She kind of has this power to go through sort of experiences that would kill other people, but in her case, it takes sort of this higher plane of reality. And, you know, she ends up being imprisoned by this sort of scientist-type figure along with other people who've had similar experiences. And, you know, the scientist believes that sort of they hold the key to humanity moving on from this world and going on to this sort of next stage in reality. And it's sort of tied together by these series of sort of five motions that must be performed together by, you know, all these five people at exactly the same time in exactly the same way to sort of open up this portal to reality. So you know, this woman, when she tells this story, and it's all kind of left up in the air how much of it, you know, we are supposed to believe in, But she gathers this audience around her of mainly school children, school boys, one teacher, but mainly they're all boys. And they, you know, and they're kind of drawn into it. They all, she teaches them these movements. And sort of at the climax of the story, and, you know, this is, again, a kind of a major spoiler, but, you know, she's sort of been separated from them. She's kind of been seen as maybe being mentally ill and taken from them. But, you know, they're all in school in the cafeteria. And a shooter walks into the cafeteria and, you know, with a gun, who's open fire. And the response of the boys is basically to get up and perform these sort of dance-like motions.
Right.
And yeah, and this is a very, you know, this has been a very controversial ending because, you know, many people see it as, you know, it's been called, you know, trivializing the idea of violence. It's been called just, you know, nonsensical, silly, and so on. But to me, and I think to the people who are fans of the show, it represents this a very kind of beautiful and powerful and moving moment, specifically because it's an instantiation of this idea of defiance and this idea of sort of doing exactly what's not expected of you doing what's not expected of you in that moment, doing the sort of most foolish and non-conforming thing. You know, some of the best commentaries about the OA, one of the best was written by Jen Chaney at Vulture.com, where she specifically connects it to this idea of masculinity and sort of, you know, masculinity, you know, functions in society as a basically a code, something that sort of demands certain ways of being and acting at all times, right? And there's nothing wrong with masculinity as sort of a way of being, just like there's nothing wrong with femininity, but the problem arises when it becomes a sort of invariant code, the sort of force that tells young men that they cannot resolve their problems in any way other than through displays of sort of anger, power, dominance.
So this, like, as we were talking about social constructs earlier, this denies that social construct completely.
Right, yeah. So this basic idea, right, and in a way sort of the shooter, even though it's not an actual character, represents a sort of abstract notion of sort of, you know, masculinity as an invariant code, something that people are trapped within, that tells them that that violence is the only solution to whatever it is they're feeling, whatever struggles they're undergoing. And so the characters having sort of met with, you know, Prairie, the protagonist, having sort of, through her, having this glimpse of transcendence or enlightenment, it gives them, in the end, a sort of insight to be put in the situation where it appears that they are facing violence. Violence is the only way in which they could possibly resist it. And instead to say, well, what I'm instead going to do is the exact opposite of that. I'm going to do something that looks so utterly absurd, so ridiculous, and involves sort of just this open vulnerability that is the opposite of what we think of as masculinity. Like, yeah. Their faith, having had this moment of enlightenment, they're able to act out their faith through this act of defiance, you know. And this narrative raises the stakes so much that, you know, it really sort of provokes this reaction from the audience where we're not sure how to take this. Because like all true acts of faith, it has to act absurd. Like, they were doing the logically correct thing to do in that situation, it wouldn't really get across the idea of faith. It wouldn't really get across the idea of the strangeness that has to result from this encounter with the transcendent.
Yeah.
Right. So you know, in that, I think it's a really successful dramatization of a similar thing to, you know, The Man in the High Castle. In a way, even pushing it even further, because in The Man in the High Castle, at least we can identify with the idea of sort of freeing a Jew from a concentration camp. We understand that, of course, that's the right thing to do. In this case, we have to really confront this idea of what it would mean if we were to see someone who had truly been enlightened. Would their actions really look so nonsensical to us that we would dismiss them, we would laugh at them or consider them foolish or foolhardy or even, you know, dangerous?
Right. Would be no reality or enlightenment when we see it. I think that's a powerful idea.
Yeah. So I think that's sort of a recent work of science fiction that engages with this notion that we've been discussing this whole time and really sort of pushes it in a direction and sort of clarifies what does it mean to sort of see the world around us as an illusion. Does it necessarily mean, you know, being this sort of Truman Show delusion where we just dismiss the world around us entirely and don't engage with it and push away from it and become completely useless? Or does it mean not dismissing the entirety of the world, but dismissing the artificial parts of it, the constructs that constrain us, that push us into immoral behavior, and just pushing away those illusory parts of it and gaining the clarity, the courage, the agency to behave as truly moral beings.
Thank you so much for joining me, Yogesh. I had a lot of fun, and I'm excited to listen to this back and sort of take it all in.
Yeah, thank you for giving me this platform. Yeah.
So thanks again to you, Yogesh, for being such a wonderful co-host and guest. Thank you, as always, to Christopher McIntyre, who composes our music. If you would like to get in contact with either Yogesh or I, you can communicate with us on our Facebook page. That's facebook.com/NovumPodcast, or you can leave a review on iTunes. I will see you next week on a new episode of Novum.